Welcome to this session of the Futures Foundation Futures Forum. We're a small group of us physically present, enjoying the ambience of a Randstad conference room. But I will acknowledge that our host, Steve Shepherd, who's supposed to be here, not only isn't here, but hadn't even booked the room for us, so the refreshments we're supposed to be having aren't here either. So if he walks in late, he gets the most opprobrium of all of us. I do hope that those of you who aren't here have some nice ambience for you to enjoy this session as well. Our guest this evening is Dr. Joe Voros. Joe has a very interesting background that he'd be very happy to talk about. His PhD is in theoretical physics, and he once worked in a number of high-tech companies, including, for those who can still remember it, Netscape. Joe's now a futurist and teaches in the Masters of Strategic Foresight program at Swinburne University, and I was once one of his pupils. I'm sure Joe will explain this evening how he first came into contact with the Big History Project, which is his theme this evening, but I do know that his prime involvement with this project is to introduce the future into the Big History curriculum. So welcome, Joe. We all look forward to hearing about the Big History Project.
Thank you, Charles. Yes, Charles survived our masters. And as you can see, he's almost none the worse for wear for it. So I'm very pleased to be here because, as Charles will tell you, if you scratch the surface slightly in, say, Big History, then I'll talk hours and hours and hours. So I've tried to create a more limited presentation to try to give you a sense of what this is about. So as Charles said, my background is in theoretical physics. I worked on extensions to general relativity. So what Einstein worked on after relativity, so that was the sort of the second half of his life. Not a lot of work in that, so I ended up falling into IT and ended up at Netscape, where I also discovered that the future arrives much more quickly than you think. So I was part of a group of hundreds of people who were fired. In fact, just today I was reflecting on the weasel language that we heard, which was, "You've qualified for a portfolio of outplacement consulting services." Or, "We're re-engineering your function," which is actually Dilbert speak or Dogbert speak, which means adios tonto, and of course you wrote in on. So after that, there was a bit of looking around, but I decided, you know, you do all the tests and say, what are you interested in? The future. Ah. So I decided to become a futurist. And so through a long, circuitous route, I ended up meeting Richard Slaughter. That's where I met Charles the first time when Richard was moving to Queensland. And so ended up at the Australian Foresight Institute, and where I've been since 2000. I started Swinburne in 2000. So for the last decade or so, we've been teaching the Master of Foresight. Now, the purpose of the Foresight program is to try to understand what's coming. And we like to say in future studies that we begin with the sum total of all human knowledge. That's our starting point. So some way of organising that into a coherent framework that doesn't make your head explode is actually quite useful. So in keeping with what Charles has suggested, the way I became involved in Big History is that, in fact, it's been my worldview since late teenage, when I first read Asimov's Guide to Science as a nerdy high school student who was going to end up becoming a theoretical physicist. Yes, Sheldon. And then thereafter, Carl Sagan, of course, produced the wonderful series Cosmos, A Personal Voyage, which was won so many awards and was seen by 5 or 10% of the global population and so on, and this idea of evolution from the Big Bang to human beings. And I never knew it as anything other than cosmic evolution, so as I was saying, physics and going on. Then I happened across a group of historians some years ago, probably about 8 years ago now, who were telling the same story, but they called it Big History. And so I found my tribe, I fell in with them, I started, you know, emailing and contacting them, and was invited to a conference in Moscow 3 years ago where I met the majority of the board of the International Big History Association, which had been set up in 2011. And they invited me to join. They said, please join the board. I said, okay. So I've just recently at the conference last year been re-elected to that. And what I try to bring to the Big History view is a more formal or disciplined structured view to the future. Anyone who does big history is interested in the future, as you'll see. And especially the students, the high school students, just get it. We don't need to struggle to instill a force-up perspective in students who've done big history. It's just natural, which is one of the things that we find difficult in undergraduate and postgraduate foresight, getting people beyond the present moment. With a 14 billion year run-up, not a problem. They don't stop. So my involvement has been on the board of that International Scholarly Association, and to, as I say, to bring a sort of foresight perspective and how to use that framework to think about the global future. So that's a bit of a potted history, my little history, my personal evolution to here. And so what I want to talk about is this idea of big history and future studies, which are considered to be a strange match, but I actually think they're a perfect match. I apologise for the hyperbole of the title, but I do believe that it's a marriage that's very, very timely. Because at this point in the history of our species, and the big history perspective teaches you about how other species didn't adapt, at this point in the history of our species, we really do need to work and act with as much foresight and wisdom as we can possibly muster. So anything that helps that is important. So I see it as a natural progression. This peculiar diagram will make a lot more sense to you at the end. If you follow me on Twitter, you'll see that's my little header thing. I'm trying to get the idea of big history and futures. So what is big history? It's about trying to, for human beings, to try to work out our place in the cosmos. It puts human history in a cosmological context. Now, David Christian, who invented the term back in the 1990s, as a kind of a joke, he was trying to teach history from the Big Bang, so of course that's big history. He says it's not the best name there is, but it's stuck. So it's a sticky name that people kind of get. So it tries to situate human history in the broadest context there is, and our civilization. Because where does history start? I mean, it's a good cocktail party question for you, actually. Historians will tell you, well, 5,000 years ago with the invention of writing. Yes, but there were people before that. And so how far back do you go? Well, maybe it's the beginning of human beings about 250,000 years ago. But there was life before that. And so fairly soon you find yourself being pushed back and back and back until you have to come to T equals naught, which is the Big Bang. Or just after the Big Bang, we don't know how that Big Bang. So big history is about trying to find our place in the cosmos. Now, it seeks to understand, this is the statement that we use in the International Big History Association. It seeks to understand the integrated history of the cosmos, Earth, life and humanity using the best available empirical evidence and scholarly methods. And so this is based on science. There are other views around that, and they're certainly welcome to have their view, but this big history is very, very self-consciously based on evidence. And in the course that I'm starting on Monday with my undergraduate students, Big History, kind of Big Bang of Global Civilization, we'll be thumping the idea of evidence. And I spend a lot of time actually talking about the evidence for these outrageous claims that are made by these mad physicists and other scientists. Now, it's been rising in profile in recent years. My colleague David Christian recorded a series of lectures for the teaching company in the United States, the Great Courses, on Big History. 48 half-hour lectures, very, very professionally produced, which Bill Gates saw, because he likes to watch stuff as he exercises. And he saw this, he said, this is fantastic. So he rang up David, said, I love Big History. Will you work with me to bring it to high school students around the world? As David tells the story, he said, I said, yes, in a picosecond. He has an Oxford accent. So I love listening to him speak because it's just so lovely. And so over a period of several years, Bill Gates put up his own personal money. This is not foundation money, but his own personal money. He has a company called BGC3, Bill Gates Creative 3. And from that, he financed the creation of high school curriculum. So it's matched to Australian curriculum framework, American curriculum, the Big History Institute at Sydney at Macquarie University. So if you're looking to introduce it, it's all cross-referenced to the Australian curriculum, if that's of interest to you. And so finally this was released back in August about a year and a half ago. So that's the Big History Project. So www.bighistoryproject.com. There's some lovely videos. In fact, what I'm going to show you is a 2-minute video that introduces that course.
It's a wonderful adventure. But you don't always see how the different things you learn fit together. It's only when you see that overall picture that it's most exciting. Well, Big History is the course that does bring it together. It uses the timeline, it uses understanding of systems and history to let all your knowledge come together into one framework. And that's why I think it's the best course ever. And I encourage you to try it out.
So this freely available version, so any educator can sign in and get access to the course materials for free, and there's a public version as well. Now what we found, because I visited a couple of the pilot schools when this was first being rolled out in 2002, in fact Nossal was one of the schools that is trialling this, and I know Melbourne High is introducing it this year across Year 9. What we found was that the parents ringing the school up saying, what in the world are the kids studying? Because the dinner table conversation has never been this good. Where can I do this course? And so the public version of the course was created, which is a reduced amount of the material. That's how parents can follow along what the kids are doing at school. So that's the Big History Project. And more recently, literally last month, that's David on the right here. You'll recognise that's Al Gore. At the World Economic Forum in Davos, he was invited to speak on how in the world did we get here? Big History 101. And so Al Gore introduced him, David did the prezo, then Al Gore got up and kept going, sort of building on to that. And so, firstly, that was a plenary session, so the idea of using this as a framework to understand the predicament of our civilization is gaining traction. But there are also several sessions on how to use it to think forward, hopefully to avoid the extinction that looks like it's coming if we continue the way we're going. So, as I was saying to my executive dean of my faculty last week, if the World Economic Forum thinks this is a good idea for thinking about the future of civilization, then I'm not going to argue with them, because it's one of the few international institutions that's actually trying to do something in a functional way. That might be a bit controversial to leave in the tape. Big History is one of the best ways to learn to see the biggest picture there is, and I will claim that it's a lot of fun. But it also leads very naturally to thinking about the future. In fact, it's inevitable. You can't not. So, what is it? As it says here, it's an unconventional history course. It's very much like the origin stories that all human cultures have had, that have tried to explain where we've come from. So it is, in some sense, a kind of modern origin story, scientifically based origin story, based on modern scientific and scholarly evidence. So there's more evidence available to tell this story or to reconstruct it than has ever been available before. So we pay homage to earlier attempts to understand our place in the universe, and we don't treat those as naive or silly. It's just that the evidence available in the past was not as much as we have now, and so the story has been refined. But it serves very much the same purpose. So it's designed to help students find their place and the place of humankind in the history of the Earth and the universe. A little thing. So we start literally with the origin of the universe, and we watch as more complex things emerge over around about 14 billion years. 13.82 actually is the latest refinement. And so galaxies and stars, the solar system forms life, human beings through various of the eras, ultimately to where we are now, and some hints of where we may be heading. That's my particular area of interest, and I'm designing a course to follow on from this so my undergraduate students can actually say, now where do we go, and I want to recruit them with the skills to actually be able to do stuff. So it's a course about understanding the whole of the past literally. Not in every detail, because that's not possible. There are only about 10 or 20 of these at tertiary level around the world. Dominican University of California, where our conference was last August, is the first university in the world to introduce big history as the standard first year experience. So it's first year experience, big history. The survey course, plus how does this work through various other disciplines, trade, through gender, through creative writing, through myth and metaphor, whatever. All of these are recast through the lens of big history. Hundreds of schools are adopting it through the Big History Project, and this is a bit of wishful thinking, really, but as we have our board meetings at the IBHA, we think, well, there will come a time when there'll be a standard course, because it's a survey course. It actually shows you how all of the knowledge that exists fits together, not to replace it, but to basically be the Milwayes key map of the atlas of human knowledge, if you know what I mean. You know, the front part shows you where the other things fit together. We don't teach people the front part of the Milwayes. We teach them the pages, or the street level. So this will be a way to organise that, to organise the sum total of human knowledge. So in case you missed it, here's a quick recap of the history of the universe. So the Big Bang. At about 10 to the minus 34 seconds. So a very, very brief moment of time. That's the soonest time that it's possible to make sense of the Big Bang. Prior to that, we don't know. There's a singularity so all physics breaks down. But then we proceed.
Our whole universe was in a hot, dense state that nearly 14 billion years ago expansion started. Wait, began to cool, the autotrophs began to cool, the Neanderthals developed tools, we built a wall, we built the pyramids, math, science, history, unraveling the mystery that all started with a Big Bang.
Hey! Any questions? What I'm going to do with my students, actually, is get them to look at the lyrics of the whole song at the end of the course and pick apart all the scientific inaccuracies that are actually present in the whole song. But I'm just being a bit persnickety about that. As Carl Sagan famously said, I won't do the accent, although I'd love to be able to, these are some of the things that hydrogen atoms do given 14 billion years of cosmic evolution. So this is the graphic that actually is the header piece of my course. From Big Bang to global civilization. Now, what Big History is not is an attempt to teach a goulash of facts and figures. I'm a Hungarian, but this is not a goulash that I'm producing. From a whole lot of different disciplines sort of slot together. What we're trying to find is the thread that connects. We're looking for what David has called the through line, what leads from each point to the next, because that's the thing that helps you to make sense of it. Our minds are structured around narrative. That's how we make sense of the world. So if we want to make sense of the whole of existence, it needs a narrative. So this is an attempt to construct the narrative thread or through line that leads from then to now. So we only make use of those ideas that are necessary to connect to what's before and lead on to what follows. So we're not trying to teach the sum total of all the scientific disciplines there are. That's not possible. Although some of us are trying to do that. Charles will attest from being subjected to my teaching. Some of us like to read everything there is and sometimes retain, you know, a few percent of it, which is annoying in class. Rather than everything that's important, we pick out the stuff that's necessary. And this keeps it both tractable and usable. So what it is, I've started calling it the kind of trajectory through knowledge that uses the through line to organise the teaching in one part, but it's also a useful analytical framework for making sense of stuff. I can see that geology fits kind of in that bit and leads on to that bit and is overlapped with biology in that bit, it helps me to see cross-linkages between the disciplines. So it's useful as a way of understanding how the disciplines interrelate. We don't teach in university, or perhaps even in schools, it's a long time since I've been at school, but we don't teach things in terms of coherence, we teach the specialties. And we expect the kids to find a way to connect it all. It's awfully hard. Now, because we teach the through line from the Big Bang to us, there are claims that this is teleological or somehow that we're granting ourselves a special case. We are not the pinnacle or the endpoint of universal evolution, it's just that that's the perspective that we see it from. You know, there is no view from nowhere, we can only see things from where we are. And so we acknowledge this. It's about humans trying to understand their place in the scheme of things. So we do have a biased perspective. There are other approaches which try to step out of that. I have a colleague at Harvard, Eric Chazon, who's been teaching cosmic evolution. He knew Carl Sagan, actually. We had a long conversation in a cab ride from a conference. He's been teaching cosmic evolution since the 70s. The discipline of astrobiology is trying to find examples of life elsewhere. SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, is trying to find examples of intelligent life elsewhere. Seth Shostak, who's a well-known SETI speaker, says that all the money is in trying to find stupid life. There's only a few of us trying to find life that can actually hold up its part of the conversation. So there are other approaches to this. But Big History is specifically designed for humanities students, or at least as a general survey course for scientists as well, but it doesn't presume scientific literacy. It helps to build it, helps to build an appreciation for it, but doesn't require it at the outset. Now, I have some colleagues at Dominican, I mentioned Dominican University of California, they've literally just written the book on how to teach Big History because they've been teaching there for 5 years. And there's a section here from Rich Simon, one of the co-authors and co-editors, and it encapsulates it perfectly. So forgive me if I read from the slide, which I'm told is a terrible capital crime. But because Big History illuminates the structures that underlie the universe, and so the benefit of the recording, it is a powerful analytical tool, and because its structure binds together content from all human disciplines, it is a powerful pedagogical tool. Because the structure of Big History narrative parallels the structures of the physical universe, even as it tells the story of those structures, Big History is at once narrative and meta-narrative. So this makes intuitive vehicle for critical thinking and for rich, innovative intellectual exploration within whatever the student's disciplines are. But most importantly, and from my perspective as a futurist, a Big History understanding in reframing all of human knowledge in a way that makes intuitive, logical sense prepares us to consider possible futures. Trips on patterns of the past and empowers us intellectually to act to shape the future. So that's, you know, that's where I get my interest. I was drawn to foresight because I wanted to understand the sum total of human knowledge, and there's very few careers that allow you to do that. So finding the Big History folks has been a revelation. So the story so far, I'll go through this fairly quickly, but we move from the Big Bang through galaxies and stars, through different planetary system formation, the origin of life, the evolution of life, and ultimately, in the last blink of a cosmic eye, the arising of human beings. I have a timeline that I give the students. Imagine if the history of the universe was 14 years long, not 14 billion. So divide everything by a billion. Human beings arose. Well, the asteroid that wiped out the dinosaurs, which you saw in the video, landed 3.5 weeks ago. And human civilization, or human beings, sorry, had existed for about 5 minutes. So that's how briefly we've been here. And so this is why my own course is subtitled for the Big Bang Global Civilization. The way this maps to the disciplines shows, again, there is a natural progression through the disciplines that arises through time. So this is very similar to the idea of consilience that Edward O. Wilson has been writing about, or has been about a decade ago now, at least, I think, that there is a logical grouping of all of human knowledge. And it grants its importance to the humanities as well, history, sociology. These all arise with intelligence. These don't exist prior to intelligence. So this is an attempt to see how the totality of knowledge, the natural sciences, the physical sciences, the social sciences, the humanities and the arts, all form a continuum. And so every human activity is granted its place in the grand scheme of things. And remember, it's historians who've concocted this. And so the disciplines follow a natural progression of emergence through time, and that helps the students to actually get their heads around it as we step through. So the key organising principle is the increase in complexity. Rather than attempting to teach all the facts and figures of all the disciplines there are, attractive as that might be, there's an organising principle which is around complexity. Now, I have lots of charts that I could show you, but I won't. But ultimately, when you do some back-of-the-envelope calculations that Eric Chazon has done at Harvard, you can roughly measure complexity through the amount of energy flow through a system. He calls it the energy rate density, the amount of energy flowing per unit mass, per unit time. Stars are simple. Human societies are astonishingly complicated. In fact, they're the most complex things we're aware of. Now, so those students who are feeling lost in, you know, the vastness of space and the immensity of time that the big history introduces you to, find some comfort in this, because while we might be small in terms of those dimensions, we're actually on the scale of complexity at the top, at the moment, that we know of. So there are other ways to measure the contribution or the place of humans in the cosmos than merely through physical extent or temporal extent. And so this means we have a responsibility. How did the universe become more complex? And this provides an important structure. So this is actually the through line, increasing complexity. So Eric Chazon talks about cosmic evolution. There's a website here. You can just type in cosmic evolution. You can see it. He's got lots and lots of stuff there. This is geared more towards the sciences. Use with permission, I might point out. But Big History, which is more oriented towards the humanities, uses 8 thresholds, as they're called, of increasing complexity. And so the through line leads from 14 odd billion years ago to today. And in fact, there are several lectures, a bit of time spent on thinking about the future, because you can't just stop. What are the thresholds? Formation of the universe, galaxies and stars, and you can see there that the appropriate disciplines that go with them are included. There's a colour coding scheme in the Big History Project. And so we come to, you know, a variety of disciplines. There's not a complete list, of course. And then there's the idea of, well, what's threshold 9? And that's where futurists come in. As futurists, of course, I'm always straight away thought about, well, what does threshold 9 look like? And so the Moscow presentation a few years ago was specifically around using big history as a way to think about the future of human civilization. Now, future studies, as I say, begins with the sum total of all human knowledge. This is a representation from the Public Library of Science online, and asks where now. This is, of course, not the easiest of questions to answer. Human systems have agency and they have will. So they're not like planets. planets can't decide. I think I'll go the other way in my orbit today. They're kind of bound, but human beings have, at least we think, have free will. Although there's a philosopher that I'm having a discussion with about this at the moment. So we consider these disciplines, and so it's the through line that provides the way to organise this into what I like to call a synth analytical framework, because you can analyse where something lives, but also use it to connect. This is both useful for analysis and synthesis. From watching Big History students, I've got to tell you that in terms of foresight or thinking about the future, they always ask and think about the future. The idea of threshold 9 emerges naturally without even having to be introduced, and it's a very, very sticky meme. Of course it is. They're young, they're going to spend the rest of their lives in the future. So they want to know what in the world it's going to look like. They have no difficulty at all in thinking into it, because after the 14 billion year run-up, you don't just stop on a dime, as they say in the US. There's a momentum that keeps going on, and momentum is conserved, trust in the physicists. And concepts like sustainability and stewardship emerge entirely naturally. We've always found in teaching foresight at postgraduate level, for example, that it's quite a struggle to get the idea of sustainability taken seriously as anything other than an annoying impost on business. And there are some people who kind of get it, but the students, this just, they see it. They get it so obviously. When you study the Mayan collapse or Rapa Nui is, of course, Easter Island, you know, the classic case of a civilization that overreached its ecological base and evaporated. They were reduced to cannibalism in the end. So there are lessons to be learned from history, which the students get. And so you don't have to work hard to instill a future or a sustainability perspective. It comes naturally. It's an emergent property in terms of because we talk about emergent properties in complex systems. So I won't go through this, but each of these is taught in the sense of what are the ingredients for complexity, what are the Goldilocks conditions. In other words, not too hot, not too cold, just right. Not too big, not too small, just right. It's not a term that I particularly like, but it's a sticky term. And so this gives rise to new complexity. I'm aware of the time, so let's step through. But you'll see that each of the thresholds has some way to organise it. What comes out, then at threshold 2, you have the ingredients, the conditions and the new complexity, and so it steps through. And this is done over a period of a long time. You can do this over a year, over a half year, over a term. There are ways to adjust the curriculum to suit any of those degrees with lots and lots of hands-on material. The earth forms, and so we step through. We talk about the domestication of animals and plants and the secondary products revolution. So a lot of stuff that... The reason I like big history is because I started off as a physicist, so I was geared in the physical sciences. But I'm a futurist now, so I'm located in the social sciences. So big history requires a lot from people who prefer one or the other. This forces you to step outside of the two-culture divide that C.P. Snow spoke about a long time ago now. So you get the overall view, you get the overarching picture. And so when we come to today, of course, human beings are conscious, and so what sets us apart from other organisms is that we're capable of collective learning. The amount of knowledge that we can pass on through our symbolic language from each generation is more than what is lost through the death of those individuals. So rather than fizzling out, which is what happens in chimpanzee societies, for example, because they only learn from watching each other, what you find with human beings is, because of our symbolic language, we're capable of collective learning that is preserved generation to generation. And ask yourself, how much of what's in your head was put there by you, and how much of what's in your head came from learning from somebody else? If I had to build this building first in order to come and do a presentation here, I'd be stuck. So the idea of collective learning is extremely important. This gives me some hope that we can actually collectively learn our way into a future that's worth living in. So we stand at the end of this, at least for us, and so we find that through the power of foresight, we're called upon now to think in terms of where do we want to take our civilization. So we emerge, thinking about the future emerges very logically from that time frame, and specifically one of the subjects I teach at postgraduate level is called 21st century challenges, and the students have to come up with solutions to the problems of the world. A little problem. I don't want to stretch it too much. But because this is it. This is not a rehearsal. At postgraduate level, we need to be thinking about how to save our civilization. Because my colleague Peter Hayward and I were discussing this today, actually, about we know what we need to do. Why aren't we doing it? It's got to be personal. So big history, I think, helps to make it personal, because it always links back to here we are now. We stand at the end of a large number of human beings. I think 100 billion people have lived, human beings have lived before us, or some number like that. Maybe it's 40 billion. But we are the stewards of all those who will come. So there's some responsibility there. So in thinking about the future, what do we want to do? So this is a slide that Charles has seen. I like to talk about futures in terms of seven types. Everything beyond the present moment is a potential future. The fundamental assumption there is that the future is not predetermined. I cannot prove this, but I prefer to live in a universe where that is the case, because it means that I can actually influence the future. I'm not bound by initial conditions. These all begin with P, by the way. So the projected future, which is the default extrapolated business as usual future, which for many people is the future. So when we get called in, I used to get called in to do consulting. I've stepped out of consulting work now, but my colleague Peter Hayward does. Tell us the future, so we know what to do. And so it's often this, which is rather unsophisticated, because the future is continually evolving. More broadly are the probable futures, which I define as those that we say are likely to happen. They're generally based on current trends and some sort of numerical analysis. Good, hard data. But you can see from the diagram that it doesn't actually reveal terribly much about what lies ahead. It's like the headlights of a car. Yes, it illuminates that bit, but what's over to the side? We need to broaden our view. More broadly still, plausible futures, I define these as those that we think could happen, based on our current knowledge of how things work. The laws of physics, law of nature, economic systems. If I tell you about an economic system based on hugs and kisses, you will balk and say, that's not how things actually work. That's not plausible. So we make these judgments all the time. The trouble is the universe doesn't care what we think is plausible. The universe just goes ahead and does what it wants to do. So plausibility is no guarantee of being resilient for the changes that may be coming. So we need to broaden our perspective even more. Most foresight work asks for plausible futures. Most of the great changes in human society have not been plausible from the perspective of the time when they occurred. So we need to go more broadly. So there are the possible futures, which I define as those that we think might happen, but they're based on some future knowledge that we don't yet possess. My favourite example is the warp drive from Star Trek. We can imagine it, we have no idea how to do it, and we may never. Although I must tell you, did general relativity, I know of some work on how to solve the Einstein equations for a warp drive solution. There's quite a bit of work now, almost a cottage industry around trying to develop a warp drive. So it might happen, but it might not. But it relies on some future knowledge we don't yet possess. We can imagine it, but we don't know how to do it yet. Now, these are all fairly cognitive. There's also a class of futures called preferable, and these are based on value judgments. These are the futures that we think we want to happen or that should happen, and of course there is the converse of that, which is those that should not happen and should never be allowed to happen. And these are rather more from the heart as opposed to merely from the head. This is how you engender action. As Charles will tell you, facilitating visioning workshops for people who are not trying to work out their preferred futures is the most vexed kind of workshop, because what is being preferred depends it depends a very great deal on who is doing the preferring. And so there's often some conflict around that. Over the years, though, I think the most important class of futures, and I've added this to the original version of this cone, are the preposterous futures. The futures where the response from people is, no, that's never going to happen, that's impossible. Why are you wasting my time talking about this rubbish? And the reason that's important is because that response tells you that you've found this edge. The edge between what you think is possible and what you think is impossible. And history has shown us that most of the major changes that have become important have been dismissed as ridiculous. There's a saying in the futures, it's due to a futures named Jim Dator. Dator's second law of the future is that any truly useful idea about the future should appear ridiculous, because otherwise it's not new enough. It's too much in this, the middle part of the zone, not at the edges where you can expect the big changes to come from. And so that response opens out that that range of what you think is possible. And so I actually seek out the most ridiculous, preposterous ideas are the ones I love, because they force my thinking to not get too settled and happy with where it is. So I encourage you to actually seek out the most preposterous ideas you can and entertain them as a provocation, in the words of De Bono. Where does this lead? Suspend judgment and allow for movement and see where this idea takes you. And then, of course, there are the wild cards, which are utterly impossible to characterise, and they sort of, you don't know where they go, they just arrive from who knows where. Now, in terms of where we are now, we're living in an epoch that's been proposed to be called the Anthropocene, or the Anthropocene, both pronunciations are acceptable, which is the age of humans, or the era of humans, because we are now so altering the conditions of the surface area of the surface of the Earth that there will be a record left in the geological record. So if we wipe ourselves out tomorrow through some sort of stupendously stupid act, or an asteroid hits us, as it might, that it has happened in the past. In fact, the reason we're here is because, you know, the dinosaurs had a really bad day 65 million years ago. You know, they were literally toast. It's a story that big historians love to tell, because one of our founders, in fact the person who actually helped found the Big History Association, is Walter Alvarez. If you know any geology, he was the geologist on the team that discovered that the iridium anomaly in the Cretaceous Paleogene boundary. As he tells the story, he took it to his dad, who was a Nobel Prize-winning physicist, by the way. Physicist always involved. And he got so intrigued by this, they thought, where the hell could this have come from? The only explanation that would make any sense was extraterrestrial. And so they published this in 1980. They were vilified, but by 1990 they'd found the impact crater. So Walter actually organised a meeting of big historians in 2010 at the Kolchak Observatory, where he found the boundary. And it's there that the Big History Association was founded. So Walter is kind of the godfather of the International Big History Association. He's been teaching Big History for nearly 10 years. He says it's the most exhilarating thing he's ever taught. So you know, we always talk about the asteroid impact, because, you know, dinosaurs disappear around there, and it's because of that mammals arose. So we're here because of that. Now, we are leaving a record that will be left in the rock strata. And so there's actually discussion now around where do we draw the line? Where is the Anthropocene? Because you need to be able to drive a spike into the rock to show it. It's kind of hard to do it because the rock hasn't formed yet. But there's some discussion around that. And that then leads to the question of, well, what does threshold mind look like if we are actually looking at the future? So the threshold card for threshold nine is currently blank. And so this leaves lots of room for futurists to think about, well, what does this mean? So one of my research programs is profiling threshold nine. Profiling in the sense of not predicting, but I'm borrowing the term from Arthur C. Clarke, who wrote a very famous book in 1962, Profiles of the Future. Not the detail, but what's the broad outline. So in the spirit of that, how are we going for time, Charles? we started late.
Started a bit late.
I've got about another 5 or 10 minutes.
Good. Five would be nice.
Mm-hmm. All right. According to Jim Davis, who I mentioned a moment ago, Jim Davis says that, and this is an empirical observation, not a theoretical requirement, all images of the future, all ideas about the future, fall into these four broad archetypes. Either it's some continuation, it's a collapse, it's some sort of constrained or disciplined society, or some sort of transformed society. So things keep going on as they have been. This is usually continuous growth. You know, in the economists will always only ever talk about this. Growth, growth, growth. There was a wonderful video on YouTube years ago about one of the election campaigns that was Go for Growth. It's been taken down now, unfortunately, but it was a perfect example of this sort of the mania of growth for the sake of growth. So this assumes things keep going. The flip side of that is things go to hell in a handbasket. And these appear to be the two alternatives that are entertained in popular culture around the future. More of the same or kaput. So this obviously comes from various eschatological ideas around the end times. But these can be due to economic crash, environmental overload, resource depletion, moral degeneration, you know, the decline of Rome, for example, the Western Roman Empire, military conflict, and meteor or comet impact, or whatever else. Think back to the 1990s when the year 2000, scary year, was coming up. There were at least two or three big Hollywood blockbusters about Earthbusters coming. So that's one thing. More nuanced views of this are that, well, there's a society that's disciplined in the sense that we don't have infinite freedom. It's organised around some overarching set of values. So whether these are traditional values, religious values, environmental values, God-given values, natural values, whatever else, there is some sort of ideological or values basis for that. Brave New World comes to mind, where you're not supposed to have meaningful relationships because they just make you unstable. A gram is better than a dam, and so on. Or there's a transformational society, and these generally fall into two main types. There's some sort of spiritual transformation or consciousness alteration. A great deal of stuff in the New Age movement around that, and it's, of course, translated across into the Futures movement. But there's also the high-tech change. And so the idea of the technological singularity and you know, we upload ourselves into computers, and so that's kind of a secular version of, you know, the rapture, the techno-rapture, it's sometimes called. Which is kind of an interesting variant on both of those, actually, sort of, you know, spiritual, techno-spiritual transformation. So the question is, which of these? Now, this framework can be used to examine any issue, or the future of any issue. If we're contemplating Epoch 8, the future, in Eric Chazon's view, one observes that we're currently being in a fossil fuel civilization. The only reason that we can actually be on the 7th floor or 50th floor of a building like this is because we have cheap, abundant fuel or energy to drive us up and down. If we had to walk up and down these stairs, I think the buildings would be rather shorter. As a futurist, I want to ask what comes after fossil fuel civilization. And the reason this is important is because we need to be preparing now. We're currently in a low point of the fuel price cycle, but this has actually been analysed in detail about 10 years ago, that in the decline phase, the Archdruid, that in the descent phase there will be spikes and troughs in the price, and they'll oscillate so wildly. We think things are nice now, but oh boy, is there a payback. I define threshold 9, and this is starting to gain some currency with the rest of my colleagues, as the historical transition when fossil fuels are no longer the primary energy source powering human society. Now, I'm not saying things are better or worse, just that there's no more fossil fuel. It is finite. It will eventually run out. On a big history time frame, when you're accustomed to thinking in terms of hundreds of millions of years, the next few centuries is nothing. And so this puts the often acrimonious debate about peak oil or peak energy into sort of a broader context, and that's part of the power of big history. It takes you out of the heat of the moment to see it from a broader context. If you've never had the experience of doing that, then you can't do it. So a lot of the stuff that goes on is rather unhelpful, I would say. So what images of the future exist? Let's run the idea of the energy that powers our civilization through these four archetypes and see what's happening. There's probably about three slides left, maybe four. There's no continuation. We have hit peak oil. It's now harder to recover equivalent amounts of energy. We're now starting to go towards replacements. This is a graph that shows how regular oil is declining, and we're making up the shortfall with non-regular sources. And that will get harder and harder. In terms of the overall time scale, this is what our oil consumption will look like on a big history time frame. We are currently at the top of the mountain. Actually, just beyond now. So, now, strictly speaking, of course, these are renewable resources. You know, for a big history time frame, they are renewable. Trouble is, it'll take about 100 million years to renew them from the fossil record. That's not a useful time frame for human beings at the moment, unless we intend to be around forever. So that's not practical. So continuation is not an option. The transformational view, generally there are several variants of this. One is that we find some energy bonanza. That's a depiction of a fusion reactor. Fusion has always been 40 years in the future since it's been proposed. So, you know, which is just about the end of the active career of the people who are just moving into the area. So the same thing happens in SETI. SETI detection is always 40 years, you know, in the future. So you must have hope. Or we could tap the vacuum energy or there's some miraculous source or whatever else. Or there's the spiritual awakening. This is a depiction of human beings sort of becoming sort of more cosmic. There's the brain mind upload variant. And then the aliens come to save us. Or at least we discover that there are others out there. And I think this is actually, you know, in terms of detection of intelligent life, simply detecting it somewhere else means that it is possible to survive your technological adolescence. And I think that's something that human civilization desperately needs to know at this point. So, which of these? Well, we could blow ourselves up. We could be obliterated. These are possibilities, definitely, they're non-zero probabilities. This becomes more and more probable as time goes on. Rusty Schweikert, who was an astronaut on the Apollo 9 mission, has dedicated the rest of his life to... he founded a group called the B612 Foundation. That was the asteroid the Little Prince came from, and their job is... they're dedicated to deflecting Earth impactors. How would you actually do it? Asteroid Apophis is arriving on Friday the 13th of April, write it down, 2029, and if it comes in, and it's going to pass between the Earth and the Moon, actually going to pass between the Earth and where the geostationary satellites are. It's very, very close. And if it goes into a corridor that's a few hundred metres wide, it'll loop back around, and on Friday the 13th, 2036, toast. So this might actually be a rehearsal for us. How do you deflect it? How do you move it out of the way? No point blowing it up. That's a stupid thing to do. Better to pull it out of its orbit and impact it into the Moon. Take it out of the sky entirely. So this remains a possibility. But there's no society left to power. So, you know, this is... we need to worry about this, but not necessarily the first thing you worry about when you wake up in the morning. The other point is that what we term collapse... if you've studied any of the history, Jared Diamond, for example, he had a bestseller called Collapse about 10 years ago. The observation by Joseph Tainter, who started this all off, and Jared Diamond, is that we see historical collapses from a very foreshortened perspective. When we look into the past or into the distance, we see things logarithmically condensed. So we see the world, or we see those collapses as very, very short. But actually, they took decades, centuries to happen. The Western Roman Empire took 3 centuries to go from you know, functioning to kaput. So the term collapse, as it says here, connotes a rapidness that may not be useful as a mental model for seriously considering the medium-term future. A better term for this is descent. And so what I see as the default projected future, this is the last slide, is that in the absence of new practical energy sources that are not sort of fantasy, or this time is different, or they'll think of something, or discovery is such as the ability to concentrate the beautifully, you know, I mean, there's lots and lots of renewable energy around. I mean, the sun's going to be around for 5 billion years. We'll be able to tap geothermal energy for about 4 billion years before we get toasted by the sun. So there is lots of renewable energy around. The trouble is it's not as concentrated or as dense as fossil fuels. And so it's not the availability of it, it's the concentration of it that's the issue. So if we could find a way to concentrate these diffuse sources, then we might be able to persist in something along the way of how we have been. If not, then we have to assume an eventual return, sort of through a mirror image of history, to pre-fossil fuel era energy sources and their availability. Basically, muscle, wind, muscle, human and animal, and wind, and a bit of water, or the sun. So here's a diagram that shows this. David Holmgren, some of you may know, he was the inventor or co-inventor of permaculture. I live in Ballarat. He lives sort of in Hepburn Springs, sort of up the road from me. He's written this in a book a few years ago where he described essentially the same four futures, but unaware of the archetypes that Jim Data talks about. The techno-fantasy, the green tech stability, the crash, or the creative descent, which is about Earth stewardship. And it's important, that term, creative descent, that we can actually do stuff. When you're flying an aircraft, you don't wait until you run out of fuel to worry about the fact that you're going to run out of fuel. You try to use what you've got left to make it a controlled descent. And so I think our civilization needs to be thinking in those terms rather than hoping, you know, that we'll find some way. I mean, this is like having your retirement plan being, well, I'll just win the lotto when my superannuation runs out. We've won it once. This was a bonanza, but twice might be a bit too much. So we may very well face a descent or an adaptation to a disciplined society where the discipline is energy. Not self-imposed, but externally imposed. So Holmgren talks about this in his book, Future Scenarios. Vatar Schmil, who's an energy commentator, talks about energy transitions. There's lots of... I use this in teaching, so that's one of his references here. Energy Myths and Realities, and John Michael Greer has written a couple of books which are unflinchingly forensic in their approach to what may be coming. Students always say, oh my God, I'm going to kill myself. Like, that's not a useful response. But this is an unflinching view. There's no romance here. This is about this was what has to be done. He's not doom and gloom either. He's just saying, this is coming, let's adapt. It's not that hard. And he talks about four levels of collapse. We're moving from a time of abundance industrialism now where, you know, you invent marketing because you've got so much stuff that you can sell that you don't have enough market to sell it to, which has only been a problem for the last century and a half. Prior to that, the problem was people having the money to buy it. With the invention of consumer capitalism, you then have the problem of shifting this stuff because you can make more than you can sell. The history teaches you that. We move to a scarcity industrialism where we start, you know, doing more with much less. We start salvaging stuff because, you know, a skyscraper like this could provide knives and forks for, you know, a small city for a year just by taking apart the girders. And ultimately to an eco-technic age on the order of 1 to 3 centuries from now where the energy consumption per capita is less. It's a much more measured society, and if it exists, then it's living in a much more ecologically viable and sustainable way. And so there are implications for the social complexity that's possible in a civilization like this. So in sum, if we imagine our future descendants, big historians looking back from the far future, what will they think of how we made the transition, made the challenge of the transition threshold 9? This is both a futurist perspective but also a historical perspective. I hope they will prove. You look back aghast at what people have done in the past with their societies. I hope that we actually have descendants. And so let's ensure that they can look back and approve of what we've done. So, thank you.